Okay, I think this is working.
Number one fan has just listened to the second time of Skylark of Space. Thank you so very much.
Go tape.
Hear now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on anonradio.net.
Yes, and this is me experimenting again, and I didn't trip that at the right time. But, yes, it's working. Okay, that's good. Now, this is another one of my I'm going to read something I found interesting shows. Incidentally, and there's going to be a lot of these, I think, just because I'm going through decades worth of analog magazines, which have some good articles in them. Let's see. Incidentally, I will remind you that I'm still asking for $1 billion to build my moon colony, so I can leave this godforsaken planet where people are crazy. Dangerously so. Not like, benignly wacky or even, shooting up places because they've got a grudge against somebody, that's bad. Shooting up places because of some bizarre theory about the white race being replaced? That's really bad. I mean, at least if you have a grudge against somebody, it frequently came out of something that actually happened. I still don't think that justifies lethal violence, but, I mean, shooting up a place because, killing people, right? Killing actual people because of some reason that only exists in your own mind? That's messed up, man. Also, it's war. War's messed up. You ever stop and think about that? Of course, if you're hesitant to give me a full $1 billion until you've seen what I do with a smaller scale project, I think that it would probably only take $100 million to pry the NS Savannah out of the cold, dead hands of the U.S. Maritime Administration, cut the ship in half, remove the antiquated pressurized water reactor and all associated machinery, which should probably go in a museum or something, and install a modern nuclear-heated gas turbine engine, for which I already have a design sketch, and then return the ship to its original purpose of visiting ports around the world to demonstrate the benign and peaceful uses of atomic energy. Okay. So I've already pulled a few good ones out of my pile of analogs, and I was dithering about which one to read. I've got one called Real Science for Real Problems, which is from somebody at Bell Labs, and it's really quite interesting. It's basically about what does and doesn't work in educational technology from 1970, with like 36 references. Very interesting. But I thought I'd read something. Onward and Upward with Space Power by someone with the unusual name of J. Frank Coneybear. Of course, I could read the preceding note, which is by Lawrence M. Jennifer and Frederick W. Cantor. I'm going to read this. The title is Fairy Amplification by Stimulated Emission of Godmothers. They used to have a feature in Analog called Probability Zero, and this is the kind of thing that would appear in it. Basically, people coming up with the wackiest idea, you know, just coming up with some absolutely loony idea and writing a parody scientific paper or something about it. One of the problems involved in doing basic research on the properties of spirits is that spirits in the great majority of cases are incoherent. This incoherency may be compared to the incoherency of light emitted from a normal light bulb. One of the most difficult technological problems to be solved, therefore, before further experiments might be performed, was the problem of producing spirits which were coherent. For example, the comparatively simple area of work in which this research group has become interested, producing coherent fairy godmothers. References in the literature, in most cases literature of a certain antiquity and standing, points out that the natural pumpkin is, in fact, a ground state of many other objects, for example, carriages. It is possible to state with some certainty that the pumpkin is converted into a carriage by the absorption of a fairy godmother, the carriage being in excited state. Presumably, the carriage decays after a certain period of time to the original ground state of a pumpkin, emitting one fairy godmother. We know that the fairy godmother is absorbed because after the carriage is created, she no longer appears in the story. It appears, moreover, a reasonable presumption that the fairy godmother must be emitted on return to the ground state because of conservation laws covering the total available number of fairy godmothers, and also the fact that the fairy godmother is available for another story later. Now, beginning with these basic principles, it was realized that although it is possible to produce the excited state, carriage, in a statistically small number of cases, by absorption of an available fairy godmother, it might also be possible to produce this excited state by modern methods of production and technological mediums, so that we will have an abundant supply of carriages. Our most successful experimental model to date involves a large original supply of carriages arranged into a latticework, very closely packed in relation to each other and placed between two flat, untenable positions. In this particular experiment, the untenable positions utilized were sin and lechery. Sin, as the literature shows us, is perfectly reflective for fairy godmothers. Lechery, on the other hand, is in some cases apparently justifiable, and for this reason provides a finite probability of a fairy godmother tunneling through it, appearing on the other side and racing off in the form of propagating waves, suitable for scattering experiments and other basic experiments of spiritual physics. The carriages being arranged in the laboratory, we remained as observers until at the stroke of midnight the first of the carriages decayed from its excited state into the ground state, pumpkin, emitting one fairy godmother. The fairy godmother oscillated rapidly back and forth between our two flat untenable positions in one of the normal modes of the cavity, stimulating the emission of further fairy godmothers and the decay of the entire lattice of carriages into the ground state, pumpkins. As we had hoped, a known percentage of this accumulation of fairy godmothers tunneled out through our flat untenable position of lechery and appeared in the form of a coherent beam. For the first time in history, we have been able to produce in a laboratory setting, under rigid control, a quantity of coherent fairy godmothers. Further results are expected from our outlined series of experiments in the problems of elf consistency. We are awaiting for this work a foundation grant of aid. Right, so that was some preliminary notes on Phazeg, Fairy Amplification by Stimulated Emission of Godmothers, by Lawrence M. Jennifer and Frederick W. Cantor, Analog Magazine, November 1965. Do you feel better now? Do you feel better about this crazy mixed-up world we're in? So yes, the actual Science Fact article here is entitled Onward and Upward with Space Power. And the blurb is, the problem of adequate power supplies for space vehicles is admittedly tough, but there's a far, far tougher problem. Getting bureaucrats to look at facts that go counter to the theory they've already staked their bets on. The author of the piece is J. Frank Coneybear, as I said. Wonderful name. And there's a Figure 1 illustration, Artist's Impression of Steam for Space Power, which is a sort of a parody cartoon, the sort of thing you'd see in a Rube Goldberg cartoon or something like that, which, you know, looks like an old locomotive or traction engine boiler hitched to a couple of household radiators and various other things. There's a whistle going off and a dripping tap. All of which is meant to suggest that the idea of using steam in space is a bit odd, isn't it? Dr. Coneybear is president of Astra Research Associates. He and several of his co-workers worked on the thermodynamics problems of the original Manhattan Project and helped design many of the subsequent experimental and research reactors. What fools we were! It was fine to show a way to save millions of dollars and years of effort in space power. It was foolish, though, to expect people to be enthusiastic over our results, or to use them. How could we be so naive? And after all, the Campbell editorials we had read. What did we do? We showed that in space power systems it is not necessary to use mercury, or sodium, or potassium, or lithium, or rubidium, or even boiling sulfur as a working fluid. We showed that with the right design, one can use that old prosaic fuddy-duddy fluid, water. Sound ridiculous? It's quite possible, though, and the results needn't look like Figure 1. In fact, they could look more like Figure 2. If the use of water and steam seems odd, don't be bothered. It seemed odd to the experts, too. Figure 2 is Communications Satellite, Mission, 3-channel TV rebroadcasting, Astra Concept, 50 electrical kilowatt steam space power plant. And the artist is Ed Price. And it seems to consist of three sections. There's a sort of a flat cylinder in the middle, a dish at one end, which I suppose is the radio part, and then at the other end, a sort of gumdrop-shaped thing, not unlike an Apollo capsule in appearance. And then there are two large radiator panels. Since we mention working fluids, we must be talking about thermodynamic space power systems with turbine and generator, rather than direct conversion systems such as thermoelectric or thermionic. For high powers or long missions, the fluid must also go back to the heat source. If thrown away, the weight of fluid required would be too great. The system must therefore be closed, with a pump to return the fluid. What's an example of an open system like thermodynamic power system? Well, the turbo pumps in a rocket engine, like the ones on the Centaur RL-10 engine, which we were talking about last time. Which do throw away their working fluid, but that fluid goes back into the rocket engine, so it's not wasted, actually. And also, the thing only has a power-generating lifetime of a few minutes, but it generates a really enormous amount of power during those few minutes. Lastly, to keep the pump from using more power than the turbine develops, there must be some sort of condenser or other heat sink between the turbine and the pump. Diagrams of two types of dynamic systems are shown in Figure 3. Oh, good. There's a very good diagram here of how the steam power and then the metal vapor power system works. And they've chosen, for the temperature entropy diagram, they've chosen mercury as the metal, but most metals behave pretty much the same way. In space, the only way to get rid of heat without getting rid of material is to use thermal radiation. Therefore, dynamic space power systems must have radiators. The use of radiators, plus the need for low weights, sets the differences between space power systems and ground power systems. The radiator itself is a nuisance. Its temperature, size, and shape determine its ability to get rid of heat. Its temperature and shape, however, are affected by the fact that heat is carried to it and through it by fluid flow, and across it by heat flow. Fluids require tubes, tubes require headers, headers require feeders, and the whole assemblage must work in space after a high acceleration boost. To top it all, everything carrying fluid must be armored against micrometeoroids. Micrometeoroids are very small particles encountered in space that zip about at speeds of about 15 miles per second. They go so fast that despite their small size and weight, they can blast little craters, which would let the fluid leak out of radiators. Since complete protection from micrometeoroids would be impractically heavy, the design approach is to prescribe wall thicknesses for tubes, etc., at values which will keep the probability that the radiator will not fail sufficiently high. A typical requirement might be a non-failure probability of 0.9 for a period of 10,000 hours. Luckily, there are very few large particles, as can be seen from Figure 4. Figure 4 is a very familiar chart to me, geocentric heliocentric meteoroid flux model. I think it's in the TRWS space data book, which I carry around with me at all times, because that's the sort of person I am. It is also lucky that the best shape for the radiator, or at least the fin and tube part, is the simplest, looking something like the examples shown in Figure 5. Which basically shows a flat plate with tubes between it. And there's two illustrations. One says heavy metal high temperature configuration for liquid metals, and has closely spaced tubes and the note 5-foot runs between headers. The other says light metal low temperature configuration for steam with widely spaced tubes and the note 40-foot runs between headers. And then it says, tubes, headers, and coolant weigh 5 to 80% of the total. Tubes provide 6 to 25% of the total area. Tubes radiate 15 to 30% of the total heat. Now, I'm not sure if that's two or contrasting the two cases. Anyway. Despite what has been said about working fluid possibilities, the facts are that about 1958 the dynamic space power business started on a metal vapors kick, which has shown few signs of remission. How did this happen? Good intentions and the scientific method. As you know, it is impossible to study a system in complete detail, since it is, after all, part of an extremely complex universe. Therefore, one studies a simpler abstraction of the real system. Equally important, however, is checking the limits within which the abstraction is sufficiently accurate. With radiators, and because of the Stefan-Boltzmann law, the relationship which leaps to the eye is the one which says that the area needed for heat rejection is inversely proportional to the fourth power of the effective radiator temperature. By an easy extension, one can then assume that the radiator weight is also proportional to 1 over T to the 4. When comparing working fluids, however, This apparently reasonable assumption can give grossly misleading results. The reason is that the combination of tubes, headers, and coolant weighs more than the fins. See Figure 5. Therefore, an increase in fin area and weight, as by using steam at a lower temperature than would be proper for metal vapors, can be more than offset by a decrease in the total weight of tubes, headers, feeders, and coolant. Also, any increase in efficiency from lower temperatures means less total heat to reject. Anyhow, the experts, both industrial and government, didn't apparently check the validity of the area weight assumption. Being more fascinated with the concept of high temperatures than worried over the difficulties of achieving them, they set the initial direction of the space power program by writing and talking of the need for ever higher radiator temperatures. Not unlike the situation with respect to nuclear waste disposal, in many ways. This was reinforced by government contracts to investigate metal vapor systems. It was also strengthened by people in the government agencies who had a quite laudable desire to obtain more results per government dollar. In pursuit of this, they attempted, in development contracts, to also advance the state of the art. Such an invitation to do things the hard way can increase costs amazingly. Worse, it can convince people that proposing outside of the pattern is commercially useless, even if technically desirable. I'll point out here that one of the reasons that NASA projects cost so much is this very business of advancing the state of the art. Now, that technology often gets released and picked up by industry in America and elsewhere, which is of great benefit globally, so the cost is worth it. But that process of getting the technology out isn't always smooth or easy, even with things like NASA Tech Briefs, which is a little magazine devoted to explaining the stuff they do every month and inviting you to contact them if you think you have a use for the technology they've developed. Some of us at Astra, however, in particular Henry Kroger, footnote says Vice President, thought that it might be possible to develop steam systems which would be weight competitive and that this should eventually be of interest to the agencies. The technical convictions were partly due to some 1952 studies, pre-Astra. It seemed almost self-evident that steam systems would be easier to develop and have better reliability. Accordingly, we began a study which continued in varying intensity for 5 years, was increasingly successful technically, and was never successful commercially. Finally, it never changed the core of a program which involved spending $100 million per year on much more difficult approaches. Considering that the work was mostly internally supported by a very small company, the output was quite respectable. It included analytical techniques adapted for steam, a parametric study at low powers, a design study for a TV satellite power plant, a design study for a solar dynamic space system, a comparison between high-power steam and potassium vapor power plants for electric propulsion, and many auxiliary studies. The TV satellite mentioned, if equipped with a steam power plant, might look a bit like Figure 2. The power plant has been described in the international journal Advanced Energy Conversion. Footnote, portions of the work described in this paper were sponsored by Advanced Military Systems Radio Corporation of America. In brief, the results showed that an RCA TV satellite concept, which had been shelved because of deterioration in the characteristics of the plant metal vapor power plant, could be successful with steam. The thing that makes this and other steam space power studies practical is the net interaction between working fluid characteristics and system characteristics. Before we discuss these, however, it might be interesting to compare the principal features of several different systems. Now, there's a table here comparing three items, Astra Solar Steam, Astra Nuclear Steam, and Snap 8 Nuclear Mercury. Now, the characteristics are powers, kilowatt, electrical, right? 35 across the board. Thermal power, 200 for the solar steam system, 300 for the nuclear steam system, and 400 for the nuclear mercury system. Heat rate to radiator, 165, 265, and 365. Subsystems, number of units. Fluid loops and pumps, one for the solar steam, one for the nuclear steam, four for the nuclear mercury. It says, sodium-potassium alloy in the reactor loop, mercury in the power conversion loop, organics in the heat sink, and component cooling radiator loops. Auxiliary radiators, 0, 0, and 1. Solar collectors, 1 for the solar, 0 for the two nuclear, obviously. Nuclear radiation shields, again, obviously, 0 for the solar, 1 for each of the two nuclear systems. Temperatures, degrees Fahrenheit. Top power conversion temperature, 1200, 1200, 1250. Bottom power conversion temperature, 280, 400, 700. Now, if the top system temperature is the same, I'm really not sure why the thermal power in the nuclear system is 100, is, you know, half again as much as in the solar system. That's very odd. I wouldn't think that would be pumping power. Areas in square feet, collector projected area, 3350 for the solar system, 0 for the two nuclear systems. Radiator, 1380, 1170, 1400. Radiating, 2760, 2340, 1400. The footnote here explains the radiating area is twice the radiator area for flat radiators radiating from both sides. The Snap 8 radiator was originally assumed to be part of the skin on the conical nose of the vehicle. Although it has long outgrown the nose, it is still assumed to radiate from the side only. Okay. Weights in pound. Collector, 670 for the solar system, 0 for the others, or not applicable. Heat storage and boiler, 730, 0 and 0. Shield, 0, 1300, 1300. Radiator, 600, 470, question mark. Total, 2360 pounds for the solar system, 2800 for the nuclear steam system, 6100 for the nuclear mercury system. Specific weights, pound per electrical kilowatt, 70, 80, 175. Now, it should be remarked here that the use of potassium as a working fluid greatly decreases the weight compared to the use of mercury. Mercury, of course, being 13 times as dense as water, whereas potassium is close to the density of water. Sodium is actually lighter than water, but its boiling point is too high. First, let's look at three 35 electrical kilowatt systems, two of which use water as the working fluid, and one of which uses mercury. Of the steam systems, one uses solar heat, one uses nuclear reactor heat. The mercury system uses nuclear reactor heat. The steam systems are from Astra Design Studies, with arrangement and cycle essentially as shown in figures 3A and 3C. The mercury vapor system is a version of the Snap 8 plant, the only nuclear dynamic space power plant actually under development. The design features are synthesized from several announcements. We have not seen a complete and consistent set of characteristics. So footnote. The future of Snap 8 is unclear. It had been supported by the AEC and NASA. NASA has withdrawn support. Relatedly, the 1,000 electrical kilowatt Snap 50 is in a research status. The arrangement and working fluid cycle are essentially as shown in figures 3B and 3D. The resulting principal features are shown in Table 1, which I've already read to you. As can be seen, there are interesting differences, mostly in favor of steam, between items such as heat rate to the radiator, number of components, minimum cycle temperature, radiator area, and weights. Why? As to radiator heat rates, the values are smaller for steam. That is, there is less heat to get rid of because of higher efficiencies. Higher efficiencies, in turn, come from greater differences between top and bottom temperatures. This effect on efficiency is reasonable when we remember that the maximum possible efficiency, Carnot efficiency, equals T1 minus T2 over T1, where T1 is a high temperature, T2 is a low temperature. As to loops and pumps, the metal vapor system has three more loops than the steam systems. It must therefore have three extra power-consuming pumps. For component cooling, the need for an extra loop is almost obvious. One simply cannot successfully cool generators, shaft seals, etc. with a 700 degree Fahrenheit fluid. The designers of the Snap 8 system are believed to have gone to separate reactor and condenser loops because of worries over flow instabilities, especially of the parallel flow type, in a zero-gravity environment. Parallel flow instabilities would be impossible in either the steam reactor or solar boiler because the steam-generating part is a Sulzer-type once-through monotubes boiler superheater. This would make it a much smaller brother of the 1200 degree Fahrenheit 5000 PSI Sulzer steam generators built recently by Combustion Engineering for the Philadelphia Electric Company. Steam condensing radiators can operate efficiently with pressure drops which would be quite impractical for metal vapor condensing radiators. With large pressure drops, they can be designed for a flow regime in which instabilities are not a problem. Footnote, the drop in temperature with decrease in pressure is a great deal less for saturated water vapor than for pertinent metal vapors. In Table 1, the weights are less for the steam systems, because the working fluids weigh less, because there are fewer components, and because some apparently similar components can be made lighter. For example, as specified for the steam systems in Table 1, the radiator can be made of lightweight metals such as aluminium. Incidentally, the weight-saving increased spacing between radiator tubes, as shown in Figure 5, is due to the better thermal conductivity of materials such as aluminium. I'm not sure, though, that he accounts properly for the savings in weight from the lower pressure of the metal vapor system, which really only operates at atmospheric pressure as opposed to 100 atmospheres or so for steam? I mean, there's a minimum gauge phenomenon where you can't make tubes any lighter by reducing the pressure inside them simply because you can't fabricate tubes with walls that thin. But I'm not sure about that bit. The solar dynamic system is of interest because of the advantage of no nuclear radiation to worry about, plus the administrative advantage of involving only one government agency. Footnote, no matter what agency is involved in the use of a nuclear power plant, the AEC must, by law, be involved in its development. The minor problem with the collector is not its... No, I'm sorry. For such systems, the collector is more of a worry than the radiator. For this reason, steam systems, with their higher efficiencies, have a definite advantage. Also, as between nuclear and solar, the solar will be designed for lower radiator temperatures, as can be seen in Table 1, in order to minimize collector and heat storage weights. Okay, well that answers my question. The major problem with the collector is not its weight as such, or even the details of how it is to open from its boost package. It is rather the need for very accurate contouring, so that essentially all the sun's rays will reflect into the rather small region needed for a black box solar boiler. This is necessary to maintain efficiency, and all of the development steps are not yet clearly seen. A small but growing body of opinion that one should assume adjustment in place by men in space would greatly decrease the difficulty and make somewhat larger solar power plants more practical. That, by the way, has basically been solved using adaptive optics. As in the primary mirror of the James Webb Space Telescope. The kind of comparison we have just made has provoked objections from people committed to metal vapor systems. They point out that it is a comparison of a design study with a system that deteriorated badly after its original design study. Snap 8 progressed from 2 loops to 4, from 400 square feet of radiator area to 1,400, and from 2,700 pounds weight to 6,125. This, although true, does not constitute a valid objection since it ignores a principal advantage. Even at an early stage, the problems of steam systems are considerably closer to engineering than to research, especially as compared with a metal vapor system. It is not necessary, therefore, for steam systems to suffer the same deterioration during development as experienced by metal vapor systems. Metal vapor enthusiasts also point out that the feeders, headers, etc. of their systems are so massive that the system itself can provide vehicular bracing. This is really making a virtue out of a necessity. In any case, even if 1,000 pounds were arbitrarily added for bracing, the steam system would still be lighter. Another potential application for space power is providing the electricity for electric propulsion. Electric propulsion, which Ernst Stuhlinger has shown is needed for manned exploration of the more distant parts of the solar system, is characterized by low thrust applied for a very long time. It does not require much in the way of propellant mass, but does require a great deal of electric power, on the order, say, of 1,000 kilowatts. Because of the large power requirements, it seemed desirable to see how steam systems could compete for such an application. Therefore, a comparison was made based upon a good design study of a potassium vapor nuclear power plant for electric propulsion. And then Figure 6 refers to this undoubtedly, says, sizes of turbine exit ducts for 1 electrical megawatt space power plants, steam and potassium. And so there's a crude geometric figure of an average man, then the potassium, 4 ducts this size, roughly the same size as the man's head, and then steam, 1 duct this size, roughly the size of someone's hand. In order to compare on an equitable basis, weights and other characteristics were examined subsystem by subsystem, in many cases component by component, and the assumptions and calculations used were at least as conservative as those used for the potassium system. For example, 8 separate radiator segments were assumed in order to provide isolation in case of meteoroid puncture. The results are shown in Table 2. Notice the recurring theme of lower temperatures, fewer components, and lighter weights. The lesser requirements as to gross electrical power and gross thermal power are also of interest. The principal reason for the lower gross thermal power is due, however, to an appreciably higher thermal efficiency. This, again, is due to a greater temperature spread, 800 degrees versus 600 degrees, as well as a lower top temperature, 1200 Fahrenheit versus 2000 Fahrenheit. Remember the T1 minus T2 over T1 Carnot efficiency. (coughs) 800 over 1200 is much larger than 600 over 2000. Normally, you get better thermal efficiency just by raising the top temperature because the bottom temperature is set. That's in steam power plants, which reject heat to the Earth's environment. Space power plants have one more free parameter, which causes all kinds of fascinating effects. The difference between the weights of the working fluids for steam and potassium is of considerable interest. Also of interest, although not shown in the table, is that even though the fins and tubes of the potassium radiator are quite a bit lighter than those of the steam radiator, the total radiator weights are about the same, despite a ton of structure arbitrarily added for bracing during the boost. The reason is that the feeders, headers, and working fluid are quite a bit heavier in a potassium system. Well, that answers my previous question, I guess. Characteristics, this is table 2, potassium and steam. Power, kilowatt, net electrical, 1,000, 1,000. Gross electrical, 1390 for potassium, 1265 for steam. Thermal power reactor, 7600, 5730. That's a big difference. Subsystems, number of power cycle loops, considering the radiator as one loop, 4, 2. Number of pumps non-radiator, 4, 1. Number of radiator segments and pumps, 8, 8. Fluid temperatures degrees Fahrenheit. Top for system reactor exit, 2,000 for potassium, 1,200 for steam. Top for working fluid, 1,850, 1,200. Main radiator exit, 1,075, 370. Component cooling, 550, 370. Weights in pounds. Working fluid, 3511 for the potassium, 230 for steam. Electrical generating package, not including reactor, shield, or power conditioning equipment, 8030 for potassium, 4260 for steam. Total, including reactor, shield, and power conditioning equipment, 29550 for potassium, 25340 for steam, of which a great deal is a radiation shield. And then there's figure 7, radiator characteristics, steam and metal vapors. Normalized, smallest is best, steam temperatures, water 1200 and 400 Fahrenheit, mercury 1250 and 680, potassium 2000 and 1400. And it's bar graphs, heat to radiator, water, modest step to mercury, modest step up to potassium. Specific volumes, low temperature vapor, water is very small, mercury about double that, potassium like 5 times mercury. Mass flow rates, water small, mercury much larger, potassium only about twice mercury. That's because of the density difference I mentioned. Volume flow rates, water very small, mercury about 5 times that, potassium about double the mercury. Also not apparent from the table is the fact that, for electric propulsion missions, potassium has the disadvantage that if the plant is shut down, the radiator fluid freezes. This makes restart difficult. For many missions, water will not freeze, and in any case, the weight of water in the radiator is small enough to make jettisoning and refilling quite practical. Of course, radiators for high-power steam systems must have large areas. However, the advantages brought by this are worth it. Although stowing and unfolding such a radiator could be a major mechanical problem, it does not, after all, require raising the whole level of high-temperature technology. Then figure 8, a lifetime for power plant rotating machinery versus operating temperatures obtained by interchanging coordinates in figure 1, TID-20079, an evaluation of systems for nuclear auxiliary power, U.S. Atomic Energy Commission, 1964. Lifetime in hours versus temperature in Fahrenheit, and it starts off at about 10 to the 5th power at about, 400, 500 Fahrenheit, and then drops off, then gently towards 10 to the 4th at about 1600, maybe 1200 Fahrenheit, and then, drops off to less than 1 hour at 1800 Fahrenheit. Again, there's been quite a bit of work that has advanced the state of the art since then, it has to be said. Now, let us look at some generalized concepts, and possibly answer some whys. Oversimplified metal vapor systems are high-temperature systems. Oversimplified. Metal vapor systems are high-temperature systems. Steam systems are high-pressure systems. They operate in the range between, say, 250 and 1200 psi. It is less well recognized that metal vapor systems are characterized by having large volumes, that is, within turbines, feeders, and headers, even as steam systems are characterized by having large areas of radiators. The effect of this on component design can be understood by comparing the sizes of the turbine exit ducts needed for the systems described in Table 2, see Figure 6. These size differences arise from the interplay of system and working fluid characteristics, as indicated by the bar graphs of Figure 7. This graph compares water, mercury, and potassium for steams operating at typical temperatures. Fluid characteristics are from accepted references. The effect of relative efficiencies on heat rates to the radiator has been pointed out before. Mercury requires high mass flow rates, per figure 7b, because mercury has the characteristic of picking up less heat per pound in the boiler and depositing less in the condenser than does water or potassium. This can also be inferred from the narrowness of the temperature and entropy diagram for mercury in Figure 3D. Potassium has about the same heat of condensation as water, so that the difference in mass flow rates is due to the lower thermal efficiency of the potassium system. Potassium's main drawback, however, is its high specific volume in cubic foot per pound, as shown in Figure 7C. Of course, higher pressures could be used, but this would result in higher saturation temperatures and still lower efficiencies. Finally, volume flow rates are obtained by combining mass flow rates and specific volumes. The results, as shown in Figure 7D, are indicative of relative sizes of turbines, ducts, and other components. Sizes and weights mean nothing if the power plant can't run when and where it is supposed to. A very important requirement, therefore, is reliability. This fact has been increasingly emphasized in the space power program as difficulties and weights have increased. The reliability which will be obtained will depend upon mission, environment, operating requirements, complexity, state of the art, wisdom in design, and care in construction. The obvious difference between steam and metal vapor systems is the operating temperature. Claims of increased reliability at lower temperatures might be controversial, except that the AEC has compiled data and produced a curve indicating expected lifetime of rotating machinery versus temperature. This curve, reproduced as Figure 8, with abscissa and ordinate interchanged, indicates that there is no applicable experience for rotating machinery capable of operating at 1850 degrees Fahrenheit for longer than an hour. That was probably rocket engine turbopumps. Of course, since the 60s, gas turbine operating temperatures have risen quite a bit. Also, since lifetime drops precipitously with increase in temperature, an improvement of 2 to 3 orders of magnitude is necessary in order to obtain a 1-year lifetime at 1850 Fahrenheit. Finally, if one believes the curve, the temperatures proposed for steam systems imply adequate reliability. The temperatures proposed for the higher temperature liquid metal systems imply inadequate reliability. The sharp decrease in reliability at the higher temperatures is due to a qualitatively different operating environment. These are temperatures at which metals are beginning to glow at white heat, and very few components work well at a white heat. These are temperatures at which all but a very few materials tend to come apart, and those which can be used are mostly difficult to work with. It may be helpful in obtaining a feel for the tendency of components to deteriorate at these high temperatures to realize that one type of white cast iron can actually melt at a temperature 80 degrees Fahrenheit below the 2000 degrees cited in Table 2 and for Snap 50. Yeah, I mean, this gives you an idea that NASA has tried to resuscitate nuclear power for space several times and has always gotten really expensive because of the use of things like lithium, molten lithium, god-awful stuff. Even the lowest potassium system cycle temperatures, circa 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit, can cause difficulties. Reliable operation of bearings at such temperatures is improbable. The practical operation of generators at such temperatures is presently impossible. This implies a need for separate coolant systems for components, and for shaft seals between rotating components. Such increased complexity further decreases reliability. An example of one ingenious but complicated shaft seal design is shown in Figure 9, taken from Machine Design. By permission, Machine Design, October 22, 1964, copyright 1964, Penton Publishing Company, Cleveland, Ohio. Figure 9 is titled Molecular Pumps Backup Snap H Shaft Seals. Start seals contain the fluids during startup and rub away during flight, which means you can never restart the engine. That's nice. It's got to run continuously forever. And then it'll just die. So for a restart, you would actually need a second set of rotating machinery, which is not ideal. It requires 1. A mercury molecular pump. 2. A coolant for the mercury. 3. An oil molecular pump. 4. An oil cooler. 5. A radiation-resistant oil. And 6. 2 start seals that can operate only at startup. This means the system can only be started up once. No restarts. Steam systems, on the other hand, have low enough bottom temperatures, 300 to 400 degrees Fahrenheit, to permit the use of water-lubricated bearings and direct cooling of generators, and no seals between components. Auxiliary heat exchange systems and radiators are not needed, and repeated startups are quite practical. No matter how carefully a complicated system is designed, however, be it power plant, space vehicle, or even submarine, it will upon occasion give trouble. Footnote. Examples in support of this include difficulties encountered with the Hallam liquid metal reactor, the Ranger series of space shots, and the first completely submerged voyage around the world. The last is of special interest because of many examples of dangerous failures to complicated equipment repaired by a completely isolated crew. Also that it wasn't exactly completely submerged. They surfaced just enough for the conning tower of the Triton to break the surface of the water so that a crewman could be taken off by helicopter to be taken to a hospital. I just remember that. Yes, that's what I do. For manned missions, therefore, the attribute of repairability, which makes emergency, admittedly difficult, in-the-field repairs possible, is almost as important as reliability. Jury-rig repairs to power plants can range from stopping leaks to draining part of the system and removing and repairing a component. It would obviously be easier to drain water and repair an aluminium or steel component than to drain potassium and repair a stainless or niobium component. Also, consider the effects of a small potassium leak and fire in a dome or cabin. To be practical, repairability must include the possibility of recharging the system. It is pertinent that water will be the only item on manned missions, which will routinely be supplied in more than adequate quantity. Further, recharging a 1,000 electrical kilowatt steam system would require at most 250 pounds of water. A metal vapor system might require up to 3,500 pounds of potassium. In sum, a breakdown or loss of fluid is much less apt to prove fatal if the power plant uses water. Technical advantages are important, but relative costs are still a factor, for many reasons, including the more advanced state-of-the-art, and the fact that steam system components, except the reactor, can be tested with little or no special facilities, large sums could be saved by a switch to steam, despite the money already spent. We believe that a 20% savings on future programs is quite conservative. Actually, a 50% savings could be realistic if careful development approaches were taken. The dollar values of such savings are impressive. The Dynamic Space Powers program is supported at about $100 million per year. The consensus of several knowledgeable groups is that it will take $0.5 to $1.5 billion, $1965 dollars, to develop a metal vapor system, SNAP 50 type, for electric propulsion. Even modest percentages of $1 billion represent very respectable savings. Finally, both technical and financial advantages are academic unless they can be reduced to practice. Dynamic space power systems still have only one class of customer, the government agencies. They also cost too much to be developed with private funds and sold to the government as a demonstrably successful piece of hardware. Even the cost of a prototype test is excessive. Therefore, dynamic space power systems must be developed under direct government support. The people responsible for that support will not have the staff to carry out long, grubby, detailed studies, or the equipment to work with hardware. They must therefore act through industrial contractors and government laboratories. They would be less than human if they did not become convinced that some particular direction of effort is correct and feel duty-bound to push in that direction. Because of this, a network of contractual provisions, directives, and procedures must inevitably develop. Such an alignment of effort can facilitate progress. It is also an excellent homeostatic mechanism for resisting change when the progress is in the wrong direction. In addition, to change a program requires that many responsible people change their convictions. This can be especially difficult for a change to an easier approach. It is not in human nature for people who have argued, written, and worked for a difficult and expensive program to really believe that they could have taken a better and cheaper approach. Because of these factors, it is very difficult to effect any change to a program from the outside, especially when using studies rather than tests as ammunition, and especially again when the change is to an easier approach. Footnote: in contrast, Whittle in developing jet propulsion was able to silence many doubters in high places by achieving a one-hour prototype test. Specifically, to bring about any major changes to the space power program proved, for us, impossible. A brief account of our small successes, plus our inability to obtain major changes, might, however, be helpful to people who want to obtain acceptance of a technical approach and who underestimate the difficulties as we did. Our push to obtain acceptance can be divided into five phases, including 1. Attempting to obtain a hearing, 2. Obtaining a small contract, 3. Making joint efforts, 4. Contributing to a change in a small program, and 5. Working on high-power systems. During the first phase, nobody would even listen. The universal reaction was, how can it be lightweight with a low-temperature radiator? There seemed no realization that the map is not the thing, and a flat plate is not a radiator. This phase, during which a number of minor studies were carried out using abbreviated calculations, lasted from the end of 1959 to mid-1961. Finally, after a great deal of effort, a small contract was obtained from NASA, our first and last government contract on space power. Pertinent to this, a special acknowledgement is due to Mr. William Woodward of NASA, who, although dubious, he still is, felt a need to make sure that nothing really worthwhile was missed. Under the contract, the radiator optimization techniques developed for steam obtained approval, and results by more approximate methods were substantiated and extrapolated. A check calculation on contract results by NASA in the form of a comparison with a low-power mercury solar heat system showed slightly better weight per kilowatt for steam. On the other hand, the contract cost more than was received, and a complete lack of interest in steam remained. This phase lasted from mid-1961 to early 1962. After this, an attempt was made to team up with large companies, although there was no interest by those already in the program, because each was pushing a favorite entry, interest was aroused in other companies, for example, Texas Instruments and RCA. Well, once again, I've mousetrapped myself. I am not sure. It's possible that I would have got to the end of this article if I had not stopped to read the bit about fairy godmothers at the beginning, but it was just too good to pass up. Since I think the rest of the article is interesting, I'll probably carry it over to next time. I hope to do some more of the pre-recorded shows, finish Castle of Otranto and so forth, pretty soon, so I'm not saying that'll happen Friday. I'd like for it to happen Friday, but I may be too busy moving stuff in my storage unit, which is my current excuse for not devoting time to pre-recorded shows. That and the fact that I have to pre-record the next a step farther out. Less because I'm going to lose what I was thinking about, I have a notebook for that, than because there is a anime club meeting on Saturday, which I would like to attend. Anyway, this is your regular reminder that Hear Now the Words and A Step Farther Out are provided to you through the good graces of the SDF Public Access Unix System, which supports AnonRadio.net. and that I look forward to reading your cards and letters, please send them to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas, 76101, United States of America. Aww.